Now, the abolitionists also tried to reinvigorate the idea of freedom as a universal entitlement. Regardless of race, every person was entitled to liberty, they insisted. Their ideas drew on the Declaration of Independence. They drew on the evangelical fervor of the Second Great Awakening. They drew on principles of natural rights. But in opposition to the racialized definition of freedom, which the mainstream society adhered to, the abolitionist movement put forward what you might call a purely civic understanding of nationhood. Here I am delving into the lowest thing anybody can do, which is talking about political science, but I will mention this briefly because political scientists distinguish between two kinds of nationality or nationalism. There's what they call ethnic nationalism and civic nationalism. Ethnic nationalism is like Germany, where the nation is seen as the representative of a particular people, a specific ethnic, linguistic people. You can be the descendant of Germans who have lived for 400 years in Russia, and if you come to Germany, you're a German. You're a German citizen because you are part of the people that Germany represents. On the other hand, you can be a Turkish guest worker, and your children are not German citizens because they're not part of that. So that's the ethnic definition. The nation and a particular definition of the people are coterminous. The civic definition, which is what these political scientists claim the United States is a definition which says that anybody can be a citizen. All you have to do is adhere to the principles of the country, and then it doesn't matter what your background is, what your religion is, what your race is, what your language is. You can be incorporated as a member of the society. The fact is that our definitions of citizenship have always encompassed both civic and ethnic. And certainly in this period, the ethnic, the racial definition of American nationality was very powerful. And the abolitionists were the ones who really put forward the civic idea. They invented a principle which is so second nature to us now that we may not even realize it doesn't go back past the Civil War, and that is birthright citizenship. Anybody born in the United States is an American citizen entitled to the same legal rights. Now, when I say we all take that for granted, it is true that back in the 1990s, when there was all this controversy in California, where all sorts of strange ideas come from, about illegal immigration and all this, the governor of California, Pete Wilson, declared that he was no longer going to recognize children of illegal immigrants as citizens in California, so that they, because they were costing money, they're going to school, health care, all this. There's how many people, 30 some odd, 40 million people in California. Nobody seemed to realize that the governor of California does not have the right to abrogate the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which put this but it was the abolitionists who invented that principle, birthright citizenship. It didn't exist. As I just said, the law of the land was that no black person could be a citizen. An Irish person can come off a boat and 5 years later they're a citizen. A black person whose ancestors came here in 1620 could not be a citizen of the United States. Birth had nothing to do with whether you were a citizen or not. The abolitionists said, no, anybody born here is an American. And in fact, one of their main principles was to get the country to recognize African Americans as Americans. One of the wonderful pamphlets that they published, Lydia Maria Child, one of the great abolitionist writers, published a treatise in 1833 with the title, An Appeal in Favor of That Class of Americans Called Africans. They weren't Africans any more than Abraham Lincoln was an Englishman, because his ancestors, they were people of African ancestry, any more than I'm a Polish person because my grandparents came over from Poland. I don't want to go back to Poland. Well, even to say back, you notice I didn't say ship them back to Africa, as all the language of that time did. None of the American slaves had ever been in Africa in 1850. They were all American-born. The slave trade had been cut off long before. These were American-born people. If they wanted to go to Africa as tourists or to emigrate, that was their right. But no one had a right to ship them off any more than they should ship Lincoln off back to England because his great-great-great-grandparents had come from England. But it was the abolitionists who insisted on that, that these are Americans, they're not foreigners, their birthplace ought to be the definition of who is an American. That idea was later put into the Constitution in the 14th Amendment, but it did not exist in the law before the Civil War. The abolitionists developed an alternative view of American rights, American liberties. They invented another critical concept, which again is so, we take so much for granted, we don't even realize it didn't exist before the Civil War, and that is equality before the law, regardless of race. There was not a state in the Union that treated black and white persons identically in legal terms. Not even Massachusetts, which came closest, because Massachusetts prohibited African Americans from serving in the state militia. Most states, and I'm not only talking about the South, but the North, had a series of laws that only applied to blacks. For example, if a black person moved into the state of Ohio, they had to post a bond for good behavior. A white person could move into the state of Ohio, didn't have to do that. Illinois had a whole series of laws called the Black Laws of Illinois, which made certain things crimes only for black people, not for white. In other words, there was no such idea as equality before the law. There were laws for blacks and laws for whites. It was the abolitionists, again, who put forward this idea that there should be one set of principles that applied to all Americans, regardless of race. And even though the federal government was in the hands of what the abolitionists called the slave power, was pro-Southern, they glimpsed the idea that eventually the federal government might become the protector of the basic rights of all American citizens. Now, the most adamant abolitionists in contending that the struggle against slavery required a redefinition of these ideas of freedom were black abolitionists. And we sometimes forget that the abolitionist movement was an integrated movement. It brought many of its foot soldiers, so to speak, were African-American men and women. A few of its most prominent leaders, like Frederick Douglass, were black, but we tend to hear, apart from Douglass, more about the white leaders, the Garrisons, the Wendell Phillipses, the John Browns, etc. The abolitionists were the first racially integrated political movement in American history. There had been racially integrated religious movements. The great camp meetings of the Great Awakening brought black and white together in religious fervor. But as a political movement, there had been no precedent to black and white people serving on committees together, giving speeches together, drafting resolutions together. But the black abolitionists took a slightly different approach sometimes than the whites. They were the ones who most vehemently insisted that the rhetoric that the United States was a land of liberty, which we certainly hear a lot nowadays, was just hypocrisy. How can you call it a land of liberty when it is slavery embedded within it? In fact, the black abolitionists refused to celebrate July 4th. What they celebrated instead was August 1st as their holiday, because August 1st was the anniversary, after 1833, of the abolition of slavery in the British Empire. And by celebrating that day, they were making a subtle, ironic point. The whole rhetoric of mainstream American society was to contrast American liberty and British lack of liberty, British despotism. The black abolitionists said, no, wait a minute. Which is more free, a country that has abolished slavery or one that still maintains it? We'd rather celebrate the British holiday, because at least they no longer have slavery. Now, white abolitionists were by no means free from the racialist ideas which were common in that society. Race was a predominant element of people's thought, everybody's thought. They thought that the world was divided into groups called races, not just the three or four that people talk about today, but dozens of races. Italians were a race, Jews were a race, Polish people were a race, Indians were a race. There were races all over the place. That was the category. Races were thought to have different characteristics. Some were aggressive, like the Anglo-Saxon. Some were religious and more easygoing, like African Americans, supposedly. Some were very intelligent. Some were scheming and untrustworthy. There were characteristics applied to all sorts of races. And abolitionist writing certainly adopts that language. That's the language in which people talk about the world in the 19th century. Some of them look forward to a new race. Ralph Waldo Emerson kept talking about how America was going to be the scene of a new race, bringing together all these different people. They would intermarry, they would merge with each other. All their characteristics would kind of come, all their good characteristics would be absorbed, their bad ones would somehow be chucked out, and some new race would emerge, would be better than all the other races. But most people, including many abolitionists, thought, no, races should actually be kept apart. You don't want to mix these races together. They're natural groups. And many abolitionists were quite, they talked about civil equality and political equality. They were not comfortable with what in those terms, in those days, were called social equality. That is, day-to-day intimate relationships between people of different races. So one should not see the abolitionists as being 21st century egalitarians. There was nobody who was a 21st century person in the middle of the 19th century, obviously. But I think what is the more important is the fact that on this level of political rights, civil rights, citizenship rights, freedom, they insisted that whatever the differences between races, they should not affect their standing as members of the society. They fought in states like New York and Massachusetts and Ohio to eliminate the laws discriminating against African Americans. They won a few victories, like the abolition or the overturning of school segregation in Massachusetts in 1855, but rather few. And black abolitionists were even more adamant in insisting that the abolitionist movement had to have a two-pronged approach. It had to attack slavery in the South and racism in the North. The real battleground between slavery and liberty, said Samuel Cornish, one of the early black editors of a newspaper. He's founded the first black newspaper in the country, in New York, in 1827, taking the evocative title Freedom's Journal. Cornish said, the real battleground between liberty and slavery is prejudice against color. In addition, more than white abolitionists, blacks identified the pervasive poverty of most free black people as a consequence of slavery, which had to be combated also. It must be part, freedom, in other words, had an economic dimension to them, as well as a political and civic definition. It must be part of the great work of abolitionism, said one black abolitionist, to abolish not only chattel slavery, slave property in man, but the other kind of slavery, which for generations dooms an oppressed people to dependence and pauperism. The idea of giving African Americans an economic livelihood was, again, one of the motivations of this Timbuktu experiment here, where Gerrit Smith gave out parcels of land for settlement by African-American farmers. And those differences would become important after the Civil War. At the end of the Civil War, some white abolitionists, like William Lloyd Garrison, said, okay, the war is over, slavery has been abolished, we have completed our task. Others, like Wendell Phillips, said, no, we must continue because blacks have to have the vote. But it was the black abolitionists who put forward the question which comes down to us in the phrase 40 acres and a mule. That is to say that there must be an economic basis created for the liberty which these 4 million African Americans have now acquired as a result of the war. Of course, they did not get their 40 acres of land. They did not get economic independence. The Reconstruction era after the Civil War pushed very far, although only temporarily, in terms of political equality and civil equality, but the sort of economic revolution did not go forward in nearly the same way. In 1850, to go back, of course, the Congress adopted the Fugitive Slave Law, which made the federal government responsible for capturing and returning to slavery persons who had escaped from the South. The law offered little protection against enslavement to Northern blacks who had actually been born free. The accused fugitive could not testify in his own behalf. It was only the person who claimed to have been his owner who could go before a federal commissioner, and if you convinced him, he's ordered back to slavery, even if he'd never been in slavery. Many black people fled to Canada as a result of the fugitive slave law, fearing re-enslavement or enslavement. This is something I point out to my students. And black abolitionists made this point very clearly. We are very accustomed, especially in New York City where I teach, to seeing America as an asylum for people seeking liberty from around the world. They came in millions from Ellis Island, through Ellis Island, etc. What does it tell us that thousands of people born in America actually had to flee to another country to maintain their freedom? That's an incongruous little part of the story of American freedom. But it's discordant, but it is part of the history of freedom in this country, as well as the more noble and uplifting elements. And as I say, abolitionists developed this sort of anti-narrative of American history. Frederick Douglass's greatest speech, what is the meaning of the 4th of July to the Negro, said, you know, to us black people, the 4th of July is an exercise in hypocrisy. It reveals the hypocrisy of a nation that proclaims its belief in liberty, yet daily commits practices more shocking and bloody than any nation on earth. But Douglass didn't just leave it there and say, look, white Americans are hypocrites. He said, actually, black Americans have to reclaim the legacy of the founding fathers, which white Americans have betrayed. The ideal of liberty is still here, he said. That's the inheritance of all Americans. Subsequent generations had tragically strayed from it. Only the abolition of slavery could rescue the United States from this path it was going down, violating its original mission. In fact, in his autobiography, Douglass tried to create a new pantheon of heroes of American freedom. He said, alongside of Washington and Jefferson, we should have Nat Turner and Denmark Vesey, the slave rebels. What he's saying is that in their desire for freedom, the slaves are truer to the underlying principles of the Declaration of Independence than the white Americans who annually celebrated the 4th of July. And indeed, it was the abolitionist movement that rediscovered the Declaration of Independence as a central document of American history. I just saw that on September 11th, down in New York City, Governor McGreevy, I guess it is, of New Jersey, is going to be reading sections of the Declaration of Independence as part of the commemoration of September 11th. I don't know what part he's reading. I hope he includes the part which mentions a decent respect to the opinions of mankind, something we seem to have strayed away from lately. But they didn't read the Declaration of Independence a lot in the early 19th century. The Declaration of Independence is a document justifying the rebellion of the American colonies. Once they received their independence, it sort of became irrelevant. You didn't have to justify their rebellion anymore. It was the abolitionists who rediscovered the Declaration, the preamble, as a statement of this universal principle of liberty. They seized upon it and interpreted it as a condemnation of slavery. The abolitionists also invented, you might say, the Liberty Bell, another one of our revered symbols. Right now, there's a gigantic process underway in Philadelphia to build a big new home for the Liberty Bell and a big exhibit and a whole glass thing and all sorts of air conditioning and all this. Prior to the 1830s, the Liberty Bell wasn't even called the Liberty Bell. It was called the Old State House Bell. And they rang it now and then to summon students from the University of Pennsylvania to attend classes. It was the abolitionists who kind of developed this idea of the Liberty Bell and used it as a symbol of anti-slavery. So my point is that the abolitionist movement in many, many ways shaped the language, the symbols, and the content of ideas about freedom that have become completely absorbed into our culture since their time. Their principles were those of a small, beleaguered group before the Civil War. You know, we see the history of that period leading up to the abolition of slavery, but nobody knew that's where it was going. In fact, if you were sitting there here in 1860, 30 years after the abolitionists began their work, you would say, this movement has failed. In fact, that's what John Brown said. John Brown launched his attack on Harper's Ferry in 1859 because the traditional methods of the abolitionist movement had failed. There were far more slaves in the United States in 1859 than there had been in 1830 when the abolitionist movement began. There were far more slave states. Slavery was even more embedded in the Supreme Court, in the Congress, etc., than it had been. The abolitionists had not succeeded at all. But what they had done was their one great achievement was to break the conspiracy of silence which had defended slavery. When the abolitionist movement began, slavery was not even on the national agenda. Nobody was discussing it. There was this conspiracy of silence. The abolitionist movement forced it into the center of political debate. And eventually, that did contribute in significant ways, of course, to the coming of the Civil War and to the destruction of slavery. And with the destruction of slavery, these abolitionist principles of birthright citizenship, of equality before the law, of civic rights for all Americans, regardless of race, were written into the laws and written into the Constitution. Those rights were then flagrantly violated for a long, long time, but at least they were there. Sleeping giants that would again be awakened in the 20th century. But I guess if some of these abolitionists were around today, they would probably say this struggle still isn't complete, it's still unfinished, but those ideals, thanks to the abolitionists, are a challenge to us that we should always be striving to live up to. Okay, thank you very much.